Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, designed for people like you who are learning American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. Every day of the year on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. Because this program is produced for learners of American English, like you, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and phrases that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. This is what you will hear on today's program. In our weekly higher education report, correspondent Pete Musto will tell us about some of the many non-traditional students attending American colleges and universities. Then, you will hear words and their stories, one of our most popular programs. This week, Ana Mateo will tell us about American English expressions using the word feet. And finally, as we do every Sunday, we will present The Making of a Nation. Today, we continue the story of the 37th President of the United States, Richard Nixon, with a report on his historic trip to China. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today, so let's get started. Here's higher education correspondent Pete Musto.
There is a commonly held belief in the United States about the best path to a college education. Many Americans would say this path involves graduating from high school at age 17 or 18, then going off to university to live and study for just 4 years, and at the end of that term, receiving a degree. But that is not as usual a path as people might think. U.S. Department of Education research suggests that the majority of undergraduate college students take a less traditional approach. Carrie Dwyer is an example. She graduated from high school in 2005 and began studying physical therapy at Temple University in Philadelphia. But after her first year, she decided she wanted to study nursing instead. Dwyer moved back home and began seeking an associate's degree at Montgomery College in Tacoma Park, Maryland in 2006. However, medical issues forced her to take time off school. She started working full-time and going to school part-time. Dwyer faced several difficulties, but she says nothing was as hard as returning to school after she took the time off. In 2010, Dwyer completed her associate's degree, also called a 2-year degree. She was 24. Then she joined the Army. Using the money she earned, Dwyer completed a bachelor's degree at Fayetteville State University in North Carolina in 2015. Now married with three children, she says she does not mind that it took her almost 10 years to complete her education. In the end, she says she only put in all the effort because she wanted to.
Ultimately, all that matters is that I got my degree done. I didn't get it for anyone else. I did it for me specifically to follow my goals and my aspirations.
Strayer University is a for-profit college with centers all over the country. Earlier this year, Strayer worked with the media company U.S. News and World Report to create the 2016 College Experience Survey. The researchers gathered information from 1,000 U.S. undergraduate students. The study findings showed that 70% of the students questioned were non-traditional. But what does non-traditional mean? The Strayer report identifies non-traditional college students in several ways. A student who passes general educational development tests instead of earning a high school diploma is considered non-traditional. So is a student who works more than 35 hours a week or studies part-time while seeking a bachelor's degree. And a student who was 25 years or older when they last took classes or when they graduated is also considered non-traditional. Information from the U.S. Department of Education suggests the non-traditional student population may be growing. In 2013, the department reported 29% of undergraduates were between 18 and 24 years old, studying full-time in four-year degree programs. Carl McDonnell is the chief executive officer of Strayer Education, the company that owns Strayer University. McDonnell says there are so many non-traditional students now because many see education as the best way to reach new opportunities. But, he adds, non-traditional students also have much different needs.
Over the last 5 to 10 years, we've had a more challenging labor market. So as people try to find well-paying jobs and or move up in their organization, a college degree is becoming more and more important, you might even say essential. And the types of programs that higher education needs to pursue, they tend to be things that are flexible in nature.
McDonnell notes that most of the students at Strayer University are non-traditional. They are often older people with years of work experience and families to raise. This means they need to be able to attend classes during the times that they are not working or caring for others, he says. McDonnell argues that most schools are much more concerned with their traditional students. Online courses, like the ones Strayer offers, are increasingly useful for non-traditional students, he says. But others suggest there is more schools need to do for non-traditional students than just offering classes over the internet. Eva Yuma is in the final year of her bachelor's degree program at the University of Maryland. She also took a long path to get where she is now. Yuma took a year off from studies after graduating from high school. She then started seeking a degree in art history at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland in 2009. More than 2 years later, she found she was unhappy and moved back to the U.S. In 2013, she returned to school and became a film major. Yuma says the most difficult part about going back to school was deciding to take on more debt to pay for her continuing education. But she also says her relationship to her school changed. For example, she says she does not seek new friends the way she did during her first few years of higher education. Yuma says she feels more professional than the traditional students. She believes she is less afraid to speak her mind. But Yuma argues UMD could do more to build connections between the non-traditional students. That way, they could share their networks and experience.
There isn't very much community for those students. I guess they assume that you already have an established community. You don't need the undergrad experience like the other kids do.
I'm Pete Musto.
Now, here's Ana Mateo.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. On this program, we explore common expressions in American English. Today, we talk about a part of our body that is usually very busy, our feet. Feet help us walk, run, dance, and jump. The words feet and foot are also used in everyday speech. For example, the English language has feet idioms that describe different types of people. To be under someone's feet means to be troublesome. In other words, you are standing too close to someone and are getting in their way. Some adults criticize children for being underfoot. Speaking of children, if someone says their home will soon have the pitter-patter of tiny feet, it means the family is expecting a baby. Now, people who are active do not let grass grow under their feet. They are never in one place for very long. People who can think and take action at the same time are said to be able to think on their feet. Some people appear to have it all. They have money, a good education, good looks, a great family, and a large circle of friends. You could say they have the world at their feet. This means whatever they want seems to be there for them. People who have both feet firmly on the ground are realistic and practical. They are not dreamy. You might say such a person is well grounded. And that is words and their stories. Hopefully, this story has given you a firm foothold on using feet and foot expressions. I'm Ana Mateo.
Happy feet, I've got those happy feet. Give them a low-down beat, and they begin dancing. I've got those 10 little tapping toes, and when they hear a tune, I can't control the dancing heels to save my soul. Weary blue.
Thanks, Ana. Now we present The Making of a Nation. Steve Ember is here to continue the story of the 37th President of the United States, Richard Nixon.
The year is 1969. Richard Nixon, a Republican, is in the first year of his first term in office. His biggest foreign policy problem is the continuing war in Vietnam. During the election campaign, Nixon had promised to do something to end the war. The question was, what? Some Americans want him to withdraw troops from Vietnam immediately. Bring the soldiers home, they say. Others believe the United States should take whatever measures are necessary to win. Expand the ground war, they say, or even use nuclear weapons. Withdrawing troops would leave South Vietnam alone to resist communist North Vietnam. Yet, that was the reason the United States had entered the conflict, to prevent the communists from capturing the South. Expanding the war would not be an easy decision either. Already, by 1969, more Americans had died in Vietnam than had died during the Korean War. For Richard Nixon, the war is a terrible test. If he fails, his presidency could end the way Lyndon Johnson's presidency ended. Johnson decided not to run for re-election after he lost public and political support for his war policies. Presidents have advisors, and Nixon's most important advisor was Henry Kissinger. Kissinger was an expert on foreign relations. He later served as Nixon's Secretary of State. Together, they tried many ways to settle the conflict in Vietnam. It took several years before the involvement of the United States would finally end. The American efforts were both diplomatic and military. Peace talks were taking place in Paris. But the Nixon administration started secret peace talks in Paris at the same time. The administration also withdrew some troops from Vietnam. Yet, secretly, it sent other troops into Cambodia, and it began bombing neighboring Laos. The Nixon administration also started bombing North Vietnam again. Lyndon Johnson had stopped the raids a few years earlier. Efforts to end American involvement in Vietnam did not begin immediately. For his first 8 months in office, President Nixon made no major policy changes. Then, in October 1969, he ordered the withdrawal of 60,000 troops. He said he acted to speed the peace talks. He also ordered American commanders to give the South Vietnamese most of the responsibility for fighting. Americans were happy that fewer troops would be involved, but many were unhappy that the withdrawal was not complete. Huge anti-war demonstrations took place in the United States in the autumn of 1969. On November 15th, several hundred thousand people protested in Washington. Nixon tried to explain to the American people why he was not ordering an immediate withdrawal. In his words, "It is not the easy way, it is the right way." In the spring of 1970, American and South Vietnamese troops invaded Cambodia.
"Tonight, American and South Vietnamese units will attack the headquarters for the entire communist military operation in South Vietnam."
Nixon described to the American public why he had decided to order the actions in Cambodia.
"This key control center has been occupied by the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong for 5 years in blatant violation of Cambodia's neutrality. This is not an invasion of Cambodia. The areas in which these attacks will be launched are completely occupied and controlled by North Vietnamese forces. Once enemy forces are driven out of these sanctuaries, and once their military supplies are destroyed, we will withdraw."
Early in 1971, the Nixon administration decided to provide air and artillery support for a South Vietnamese invasion of Laos. The goal was to stop supplies from reaching North Vietnam through that neighboring country. South Vietnamese forces destroyed many enemy weapons, but they also suffered heavy losses, and many American planes were shot down. After 6 weeks, the South Vietnamese were forced to withdraw. Many members of the United States Congress were angry. They said the invasion of Laos was another in a long series of failures. Nixon's administration had said the United States was winning the war. Opposition Democrats in Congress said the administration was lying. Criticism by the American public grew louder as well. Demonstrations took place across the country, including on college campuses. On May 4, 1970, National Guard troops shot and killed four students during protests at Kent State University in Ohio. This is what Neil Young means when he sings of four dead in Ohio in a famous protest song that he wrote in reaction to the killings. President Nixon said again that the United States must not permit North Vietnam to take over South Vietnam. Lyndon Johnson had said the same thing when he was president. Many Americans had accepted the war, but as it continued and as more Americans died in Vietnam, public opinion changed. In 1965, 61% of those questioned said they approved of the war. By 1971, 61% said they did not approve of it. The official peace talks in Paris offered little hope of a negotiated settlement. Over a period of several years, each side made proposals only to have the other side reject them. President Nixon wanted to address the public's anger over the war, so he announced that Henry Kissinger had held 12 secret meetings with North Vietnamese officials. But those secret meetings made no more progress than the official talks. In late March 1972, North Vietnam launched a major offensive. In May, Nixon ordered increased bombing against roads and railways in the north. By the end of August, the communist offensive had been stopped. Yet, many lives had been lost. The pressure to withdraw American forces grew stronger. For the next 5 months, the Nixon administration continued a policy of official talks, secret meetings, and increased military action. Finally, the president announced that an agreement had been reached at the peace talks in Paris. There would be a ceasefire, and negotiators from the United States, South Vietnam, North Vietnam, and the Viet Cong would sign the agreement. Under the terms of the agreement, all American and Allied forces would withdraw from South Vietnam. The North and South would be free to settle their conflict without interference from other countries. President Nixon announced the news from the White House.
At 12:30 Paris time today, January 23, 1973, the agreement on ending the war and restoring peace in Vietnam was initialed by Dr. Henry Kissinger on behalf of the United States and Special Advisor Lee Duc Tho on behalf of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. The agreement will be formally signed by the parties participating in the Paris Conference on Vietnam on January 27, 1973, at the International Conference Center in Paris. The United States and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam express the hope that this agreement will ensure stable peace in Vietnam and contribute to the preservation of lasting peace in Indochina and Southeast Asia.
Yet the fighting continued and would continue even after Nixon resigned from office in 1974. April 30th, 1975, marked the fall of Saigon, the South Vietnamese capital, after the withdrawal of American troops. The North Vietnamese had planned a two-year campaign to take Saigon. It would take them just 55 days. Another foreign policy issue for the Nixon administration was China. Here was Nixon's chance to shine as a statesman. Communists took power in China in 1949. The United States, however, did not recognize the Communist Party government on the mainland. Instead, it recognized the nationalist Chinese government in Taiwan. In the early 1970s, the Nixon administration began trying to improve relations. It eased restrictions on travel to China, and it supported a visit to China by the United States table tennis team, so-called ping-pong diplomacy. Then President Nixon made a surprise announcement. He himself would visit China. The historic event took place in February 1972. Chinese Premier Zhou Enlai and Party Chairman Mao Zedong greeted the American president. Nixon and Zhou Enlai held talks that opened new possibilities for trade. The next year, Nixon sent a representative to open a diplomatic office in Beijing. After more than 20 years, the two countries were communicating again. They would not establish full relations, however, until 1979, when the United States stopped recognizing Taiwan. Many Americans were happy at the easing of tensions with China, even as the Cold War with the Soviet Union continued.
Many Americans were proud to see their president standing at the Great Wall of China. Historians would later call it the greatest moment in the presidency of Richard Nixon. In fact, Nixon might have been remembered as one of America's greatest presidents, if not for a break-in at Democratic Party headquarters. It led to a history-changing series of events that came to be known as Watergate. That will be our story tomorrow. This Making of a Nation program was written by David Jarmul, Steve Ember, and Gerilyn Watson. It was presented and produced by Steve Ember, and we thank them all. You can find the entire Making of a Nation series online with transcripts, MP3s, and images at learningenglish.voanews.com. While you are visiting our website, you can also read and listen to longer versions of the stories that you have just heard on this program. You can also read, listen to, and download our other programs. And you will find captioned videos and lessons to test your American English skills. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington.